my best friend, my mentor, my prayer partner, my little brother, Keith L.
Damn you, Mike. My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm a profoundly grateful alcoholic. I'm a member of the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock in Wilmington, North Carolina. If you're ever there, please come and visit. I really want to thank my dear friend and older brother, Mike. Maybe he'll let me use his car. And I want to thank my lovely wife, Julia, who is at home. She isn't well, but I know exactly what she's doing right now. At this moment, she's in our prayer room praying for me, because every hour that I speak, wherever I am, she prays. And she told me to tell Mike that she had prayed for him this morning, and I told her if anybody needed it, it was Mike. And I want to thank Charles and Betty for asking me. I've looked forward to coming here more than you know, and Paul and Ann. And I also want to thank them for a little thing they did not too long ago when they discovered that my friend Mike was winning over cancer. They got in a car and drove from Texas to Maryland to wish him well. And that would only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank all the red shirts for everything they did this weekend, and I really appreciate it. You know, nothing shows Alcoholics Anonymous like selfless service. And I was up early in the morning. I get up about 4 o'clock, and I walk down here to get a cup of coffee, and they're already up and getting ready. Or maybe they didn't go to bed. I don't know. Mike and Joe Allen for picking us up. It was just wonderful. They're terrific. Mike let me drive his PT Cruiser around the block, and by the time I got back, I was talking like Jim Cagney. I want to thank Leslie and Octavia, Jack. God, what a wonderful message that was today. I want to thank my brother Mike and Charles's brother Mike for the wonderful job he did, and I look forward to hearing Susan and Father Peter. And I want to thank Father Peter for having Mass today and that beautiful message he delivered. And the theme of this conference is that it's in the giving of the love. And you've done that here as well as any place I've ever been. I've been doing this for a pretty long time. I know I don't look that old, but I've been doing it a long time. And I've never felt better than I felt here. There's something very sacred and holy about this place. And that's something for a Catholic to say about a Baptist retreat center. There really is. And I know what it is. It's the love that's here and was brought here. And what's extraordinary about that for me isn't that it's here or that I recognize it. What's extraordinary is that I'm actually able to receive a little bit of it. I never had the humility to receive love. I was a kid who was born in a small town in Ohio. I was Irish. I was the eldest son, second child in a family of 11 children. I won't tell you what church we went to. It had something to do with bingo, but I won't say much else. And you know, I would have told you that we were poor, and I would have been dead wrong. It's true, we didn't have any excess material goods, but we were anything but poor. You know, I had a mother who every day I let her would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And I had a father who every day I let him would spend time with me. And there was something about me, and I don't understand it. To this day, I don't understand it. And it's not important to understand it. It's just important to know that it's true. And the thing about me was I was isolated. I was a secretive kid, and there was absolutely no reason in the world for me to be isolated, but I was. What being isolated meant to me was I couldn't experience a tremendous amount of love and caring that existed in that house. You know, I had a mother, like I say, and she, you know, she had never finished high school, and she was an illegitimate child, and began singing in bars at age 12 to make money, and had an alcoholic mother, and extraordinary woman in every way. Every night, it was funny, every dinner, we would have to have grammar lessons before we could eat. First, we'd say, we'd bless the food, we'd say our grace, and then we would have to listen to a grammar lesson or a word. We had to learn a word a week, and we had to learn the definition, we had to use it during the course of the week. And that's what this uneducated woman did for us. And, you know, some years later, she was going in for heart surgery, and they'd already given her that joy juice, and we were all up in Pittsburgh, and they were ready to wheel her in, and she said, wait just a moment. And they stopped, and the surgeon and everybody was there, and she got up on one elbow, and she said, look at me, boys, look at me. And we said, yes, mother. She said, never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition. Okay, Mom. The surgeon looked at me and he said, I never heard anybody say that before. And just an extraordinary human being. And you know, I couldn't experience it. And it's the saddest thing, because it was there. And for some reason, it wasn't there for me. We have a friend, Mike sponsored him, and he was a dear friend of mine. His name was Bob Brown. And if Bob had been here, he would have won the golf tournament. He's an incredible golfer. And he's gone now, but Bob used to say the problem with alcoholics is they're never loved the way they think they need to be loved. And that was certainly true for me. And I was always, and I challenged everybody in my life to love me, and God, they loved me, and I couldn't experience it. And I was a kid who, for whatever reason, was totally alone and isolated. And I was a kid who had something lived under his bed. And I, you know, at night I'd put my little ear against the mattress and I'd hear it moving around down there, and I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over to the side of the bed, and I was history, and I knew that, you know. And I also knew I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I expected one day they'd all be at breakfast and they'd say, where's Keith? Oh no, the thing under the bed got him. And I just knew that, you know. And I was a kid who, and my mouth, I had a horrible speech impediment, but my mouth was always getting me into trouble. This morning I got up about 4:30 or something. I was sitting out on the little balcony and I was saying my rosary this morning, and I was watching, there was a skunk running around out in the field, and I was reminded, I was in the second grade, and I never meant to say these things. It just came out. And you know, the nun was talking to us and she said, you know, our friend the skunk has almost no natural enemies. And I said, he doesn't have any friends either. And I don't know where that came from. It just came out, you know. So I had to write Brother Skunk 500 times, you know. And I remember watching Mom make sandwiches in the morning. It was like, she looked like a dealer from Vegas. She'd deal out their bread and deal out their bologna, you know. And you know, in a large family, every kid always wants something different. And so my brother Henry came home one day, and he said, Mom, he said, I told you I only wanted one sandwich, and you gave me two sandwiches. Well, what she had done was she cut the sandwich in half. And now, Henry's not the sharpest tool in the box, but so she said, Keith, you know, I'm the eldest brother in an Irish family, so of course it falls to me to train and teach. And she said, Keith, would you please explain to your brother Henry? I don't have time. I said, yes, Mom, I'll take care of it. Don't worry. So the next morning, I fixed Henry's lunch, and I took a half a sandwich and cut it in half. It was an experiment. And he brought a quarter of a sandwich home, really hungry. And that's the way it was in our house. And you know what was crazy? I didn't realize it, but I yearned. You know, Bill says that there's, and Aquinas said it too, that there's something inside of every man and woman that yearns for God. And I yearned for God, and I yearned for my father's approval, and I yearned for him to tell me he loved me. And I never heard it. I'd have to be blind not to see it, but I never heard it. And I grew up one of those guys who hadn't gotten it right with Dad. And I'm convinced, it's just my theory, and I got my sponsor degree with me, and he's smart, Tom I. And you know, if a guy doesn't get it right with his dad, he just doesn't get it right. Doesn't get it right with his God. He doesn't get it right with his wife. He doesn't get it right with anybody. And and I couldn't get it right with my dad. And it was all because I couldn't hear what he was saying to me. I was a kid who tried to be good, and I wasn't very good at it, so I decided I'd be bad. So I became what they call mischievous. And I went to a little Central Catholic high school, and the school board was made up of all the pastors of the parishes. And I got a call one time, and it was Monsignor Close, and he said, "Keith," and he used to call me Little Potato. I served Mass for him. He said, "Little Potato?" I said, "Yes, Monsignor." He said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And he said, "Oh," he said, "I'm so glad." He said, "I was at a school board meeting. Your name never came up. I thought perhaps you were ill." I'd get into trouble. I'd have to serve detention. And when you served detention in my high school, you had to serve with Sister Victoria. And Sister Victoria was the nun who ran the library. Now, this tiny little library, some old dusty books, and she'd walk around like it was a library of Congress. She'd think she was doing God's will, the way she acted. And she would say odd things like, "Every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king." We'd look at each other and call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary and things. And when you served detention, you had to go be with Sister Victoria, and you had to make rosary beads. Those are things that Catholics pray on, and they give you wire and beads and pliers and all this stuff, and you had to make rosary beads. I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and she used to put me behind a magazine rack because she said I was a prince, but I was contagious. So I'd sit back there and make rosary beads, and mine were different. Your standard rosary bead has 10 beads on each decade, and I made them with 11 beads on each decade. And they'd take these rosaries and they'd send them around the world to missions and things like that. And after 4 years, there were hundreds of mutant rosary beads out there. And she never caught on. And you can't leave without them knowing. It would be like wasting 4 years of your life. So I went to tell her what I had done. I said, "You know what I've been doing the last 4 years, Sister?" She said, "Yes, I do, you sly little prince." She said, "You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why." And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these. And she said, "People all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you just hate people like that? Then she did something that terrified me, and she took both of my hands in her hands, and she looked deep into my eyes. She is a spiritual person. She was an eye person. I was a shoe guy. I looked at shoes, but she looked at eyes, and she looked deep into my eyes, and she said, "You're a very special child of God, and one day you're going to go around the world and tell his children how very much he loves them." And so, in honor of Sister Victoria, if you don't know it, God really does love you. Okay, Sister? Okay. Got that over with. I graduated from high school, much to everyone's surprise. And actually, I was a merit scholar with deplorable conduct grade. That's what I was. And I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. It seemed to me everybody in the world knew what they were going to do but me. So I knew I had to leave, because if I left, they would think I was doing what it was I was going to do. And the only way you left back then was you went to college, and it wasn't in the cards, because I had a sister in college already, and my brother Denny was a year younger, and Denny had a rheumatic heart, and it was very clear he had to go to college, and old Dad was working as hard as he could already, raising 11 of his own kids, and then he raised kids who had no place else to go. Never owned an automobile or anything. I remember one time I said to him, "Dad, why can't we have a car like other people?" And he said, "Which one of your brothers and sisters do you want to trade in?" And I said, "Well, this is a union area. I guess we ought to go by seniority, Dad." And he never got it. But I took my very first inventory. I stood in front of the mirror, and I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways and stuck my chest out. And I was 5 feet 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And the problem with that was I had failed to share that with my parents, and I wasn't yet 18, so they had to sign for me. And the recruiter showed up with the papers. My mother almost died, a poor thing. And I remember she cried all night. She kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So with that vote of confidence, the next morning we got a taxi cab and went over across the river to Wheeling and got on a bus and went to Pittsburgh. And it was the second longest trip I'd ever been on. It was 60 miles. And once I had gone to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. And I knew nothing about anything. I was just a terrified, frightened little kid who didn't know he could ask. And the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps is they took a certain number of young men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew. And I knew I couldn't ask. And that's what was crazy about this whole thing. I just knew that I couldn't ask. And it was a bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. So that afternoon, I was sworn into the Marine Corps, and there were three guys from Pittsburgh. And we had about 8 or 10 hours before the train left, and they said, "Hey, kid, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a few beers." And I said, "That's just what I was thinking." I was a guy who guessed at stuff. I had no earthly idea what was going on. And so what I did was I'd watch you, and I'd do it so quickly after you did it, it would look like we were doing it together. And so I followed him over to this bar, and it's the second time I drank. The first time I drank, it's important to talk about your first drink, I think, because, you know, if you don't drink, it's hard to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Jack can attest to that. First time I drank, I was 5. I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was 5. And my brother Denny and my dad and I were at home, and we were sitting around a table playing cootie or some game, and mom was either at the bingo or having a baby or something. And I guess dad just thought it'd be fun, you know, and it was rarely alcohol around our house because both of my parents had parents who were alcoholic. But dad just took 3 beers out of the refrigerator and gave one to me and one to dumb Denny, and he took one. And I drank it, and nothing happened to me. Nothing. I was perfectly fine. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening, and he was rolling around under the table singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and other drinking songs, and dad panicked, and he wrestled him to the ground, and he took his clothes off and put his jammies on. He took them up and put them in his little crib, and I'll never forget this, you know. Denny's singing and carrying on, having the best time, and he stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, it was the saddest thing. Denny just never made it. Now, we're not proud of this, but the truth is the truth. Denny did some strange things. He grew up, reminds me a lot of Jack, actually. But he grew up, and, well, Denny went to one college. Oh, yeah, it gets worse. He had one major. He graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing, graduating in 4 years, you know. He went to one graduate school, graduated first in his class, and he's offered like 8 jobs. He took one. About 6 years ago, he retired. He's a senior vice president of a large international corporation. The strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's the guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old. He let it slip through his fingers, you know. I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. But the second time I drank was that night in that bar in Pittsburgh. And anybody who's alcoholic knows what happened to me. Somewhere between the second and third drink, my life changed. And it changed in a way was to dictate the terms of my life for as long as I lived. And all those things that happened to us happened. You know, I became brilliant and magnificent. You know, this place I remember was filled with a bunch of men when I went in, and I was intimidated and fearful, you know, and all the men had real women with them, you know, how they are, you know. And, you know, real women hang around with real men, and guys like me used to get what was left. And the bartender came over, and he said, "What do you want?" And my first thought was, "Oh, my God, a quiz." That's just it's the way I felt about life. I thought when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper." They were going to ask a bunch of questions, and I studied all the time. I just never studied the right stuff. And So I didn't know how to answer that question. So I did what I always did. I watched the other people, and I did what they did. And then they came back, asked the same question, and I watched them, and they said the same thing, so I did too. They came back the third time. I ordered first. I'd become a leader. And it was magnificent. I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up. I couldn't help it. The floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me, and my right shoulder was out, and my left shoulder, and the muscles were rippling through my body, and the mind of it had been filled with terror and fear. Boom, was crystal clear. And I remember thinking, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? And for the first time in my life, I saw the big picture. I understood what it was all about. It was amazing. I knew about God. I knew about women. I knew about everything. And I looked around the room, and my heart broke because the room was filled with a bunch of pathetic, sniveling little men. You know? And all of them had women with them or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And you know, my sponsor said to me, you know, you could have quit drinking then. I said, Tom, who would have wanted to? That's the first time in my life I felt that good. And I drank till we had to go catch the train. And then I went to the train. I think I went to the train because I woke up on the train. And I think that's logical. And I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was, they had wet me too. So I got up and changed clothes and got off the train, and the guy said, what took you so long? And I didn't share. And they said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to get something to drink. And we were in Washington, D.C., and I found a bar and drank breakfast. Got back on the train, and I drank till we got to South Carolina. And I fell off the train. And I don't know what happened. They moved the bottom step or something, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks, and a very rude man they had sent to greet us was there. And he was shouting obscenities at myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd get along a lot better if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to get across to him. And you know, they say you learn from every experience. And what I learned from that experience is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that experience. And I don't mean to be indelicate, but you can throw up while you're doing push-ups, in case you're interested. The next day, with a very large head, they put us on a bus and took us across the bridge to Paris Island, and I was welcomed to the Marine Corps. And I must tell you, I loved it from the first day. The craziness and the screaming and the carrying on wasn't all that different from my house. And I mean it. I loved it. I fell right into it. And I made up my mind I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps if they'd have me. And I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island. And every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps one time. And I worked hard, and I received an appointment to Quantico, to OCS. And I would have been the youngest commissioned officer in the Marine Corps. I would have been commissioned before the guys I went to high school with completed college. The only problem was I was an alcoholic. And what being an alcoholic, I think, means to me is that, you know, there's an enthusiasm about us that's unbelievable. And if you don't believe that, just look around. And we're terribly enthusiastic about life. And then gradually, and not so gradually, I began to violate every principle associated with that life. Alcoholism is an illness in me that made me violate everything that meant anything. And, you know, shortly before I was to go to officer's candidate school, we were in Santo Domingo in 1965, and I led a patrol of men into town in a blackout. We took fire and returned fire. And by the grace of God, nobody was hit. But I woke up the next morning, and I wasn't supposed to have taken a patrol out that night. I did it every other night. So I began, the night I didn't go out, I began drinking as soon as 5 o'clock or so. The night I went out, we'd come back, then I began drinking. And I woke up, I was fully clothed. I had my .45 automatic in my holster. There were 3 rounds missing. It was around the chamber, and the hammer was back. I almost never slept like that. And they were waking me up so I could go over and report on the patrol the night before. And I didn't even know I'd been on a patrol the night before. And it terrified me, and I turned down the commission and got out. And then I blamed them for what happened to me. And that's the story of my life. I drifted from pillar to post. I ended up living in a Jesuit theologate at Georgetown, or at Woodstock College in Woodstock, Maryland. And I went to work there for a man who was a geneticist and began drinking alone there. And my alcoholism just continued to progress, and I ended up directing genetics laboratories, a supervisor at Georgetown University, and I had captured some poor woman and married her, and we had our first daughter, Kelly. It's gorgeous, just the love of my life, Kelly. And then we had our second daughter, and she was 3 months premature, and her father was passed out on the living room floor watching a test pattern in his underwear when she decided it was time to join us. And her mother couldn't wake me up, and she finally threw water on me and still couldn't wake me up. And in a panic, she got our neighbors who came over. And so when I opened my eyes, I was lying on the floor in my underwear, soaking wet from the water my wife had poured on me, trying to wake me up. And I was outraged. I knew that if this kid would have come on time, I'd have been all right. If they'd have waited till I was all right, she'd have carried her for 3 years. But I got up and I put her in a car and sped across Washington, D.C., and took her to the hospital that I worked in and demanded they take care of her. And I was a drunken embarrassment. And this little thing was born, and she weighed less than 2 pounds. And I couldn't handle it. I could so relate. I couldn't handle it. I just went home. And my wife called me and said, "Please come back. Our baby's going to die. Please come back." And I was in a rage, and I got in a car and drove back across Washington. And I went in, and the chief resident was a woman named Mary Kate Davitt. She and I were classmates in high school back in Ohio. And here she is, the chief resident on the neonatal nursery. And she pulled me aside, and she said, "Keith, we have an experimental machine." She said, "We just got it a few days ago, and we put it together yesterday. We'd like to put your little girl on it. We don't think it'll make a difference. We think that she'll be retarded if she lives, but we don't think she'll live. I had to be honest with you. But we'd like to put her on the machine." And I said, "Have you talked to her mother?" And she said, "We can't." And I looked, and my wife was walking back and forth in a state of shock with a 1,000-yard stare. And I said, "Do whatever you think you have to do." And she explained to me how important it is that these kids be touched and that they be loved. And I was terrified to go in there. I'd long since figured out that if God figured I wanted something, he took it away, because everything that was important to me was disappearing from my life. And I went in, and when I had to, I didn't do it because I was a father, and I did it so I wouldn't look bad in front of the people with whom I worked. And we had an office across from the neonatal nursery, and I would sit in there at night with the light out, and I'd watch my wife pace back and forth. And 72 hours is particularly critical for these kids, and I watched my wife go in and baptize our infant child because they didn't think she lived through the night. And I knew what to do because I watched my father. My father was the greatest father and the greatest husband I ever saw in my life. He'd have gone in, and he'd have put his arm around his wife, and he'd say, "Pat, with God, we can do anything." I knew all the words. I knew all the actions. I just couldn't do it. There was nothing left inside of me. And I ran down to the chapel. You know, Georgetown's a Catholic university, and I ran down to the chapel, and I hadn't been in the chapel in a long time. I'd long since given up on God. And I went in front of the tabernacle, which was my favorite place as a kid. I'd never go by St. Mary's that I didn't go in and spend time in front of the tabernacle. And even on a ball game, I'd run by and say, "Jesus, I'm going to go down and play. You can come if you want to." And it was my place. And I hadn't been there in a long time. And I went in, and I got on my knees, and I wept, and I begged God to let my little girl live. And I said to him, "If you'll let her live, I'll do anything. If you let her live, I won't drink." And I was drunk in 12 hours. I never want to forget that I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. You know, I love Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher and theologian. He said, "God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor." And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. And that's not the God I know today. And she lived. It was an amazing thing. She went on to graduate with honors from Auburn University, and she's got two beautiful little girls of her own now. I was speaking down in the panhandle of Florida a couple years ago, and I called her and said, "How you doing, baby?" And she was crying, and she said, "Daddy," she said, "I have kidney stones, and I'm having contractions, and the baby might come early, and I'm afraid if she comes early, she'll be just like me." And I said, "If she's just like you, you'll be the luckiest parent in the world." And I borrowed a car from an AA friend and drove about 4 hours up to her, and was able to sit with her and talk to her and pray with her. And turn around and ride back, and just in time to speak, and my heart was full. You know, you can't live like that and be married. And one day my wife finally said, I can't live like this anymore. She said, I'm afraid you're going to burn the house down with the kids in it and all that. And I knew she was right. And I packed two suitcases and I left. And there's a tremendous amount of relief in that. I think with our spirit and with our heart goes our courage. And I was a complete coward by this time. I wish there were another word, but I just can't think of one. I was a coward. Life had whipped me. I was overcome. And I went to where I needed to go. And I went to the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And I was living in the basement of a house. I won't go into the details, but May the 13th, 1973, I went in to what passed for a bathroom to end my life. You know, a lot of people think that suicide's a big deal. You know, it's not for an alcoholic. For an alcoholic, it's just the next deal. You know, it's like I spent 12 years trying to go back to that night in Pittsburgh. I just wanted to get back to Pittsburgh. You know, one day I went into the NCO club and I ordered a double scotch. And they said, Corporal, that'll be 70 cents in your career. And I thought, that's about right, and I paid it. Anything to get back to Pittsburgh. And then, you know, one day I went for a bottle of gin or something, and they said, it'll be $7.75 and your wife and your two daughters. And I thought, that's about right. Whatever it takes to get to Pittsburgh. And then one day I went to buy something, God knows what, and it was probably 79 cents and your life. And I thought, that's about right. And I went in, and an extraordinary thing happened to me. I looked in the mirror and I said, you're 29 years old, at least it'll be over. And I had a bunch of pills in there. I never took them. I know some of you think it's the saddest story you ever heard, but I thought if God made anything better than booze, he kept it for himself. And I was just not interested in anything else. And a woman spoke to me. Now, you got to know, I'm not happy with women and at this stage of my life. And a woman spoke to me and told me it was just starting. It was like a bolt of lightning. I never forget it. All of a sudden, my mind was crystal clear, and I remembered that my estranged wife had given me some phone numbers and said, I can't help you. Maybe these people can. And I ran out, and I pulled a drawer out, and it fell all over the floor, and I was crawling around on my hands and knees, sobbing like an idiot, and I found a phone number, and I called it. And it was to a treatment center. And I know there are people who say bad things about treatment centers, which strike me as odd because we don't have opinions in Alcoholics Anonymous, I called and I talked to an alcoholic. I talked to someone who knew how to talk to someone like me. And she calmed me down and got my number and called me back. And I know now because she knew how suicidal I was. She told me that I could come out there in 3 days and did I need help stopping. And you know, the only time I'd ever stopped was one day I came out of a blackout and had blacked my wife's eye in a blackout. I just loathed myself, and I tried not to drink for a while, and I didn't drink for a while, and it was so bad that she asked me to drink again. That's how bad it was. And I said to her, no, I can stop on my own. I had no idea what I was saying. I hung up the phone, and I looked, and there was almost a full bottle of scotch on a draining board. And I didn't know AA existed. I didn't. But I knew what the problem was. I knew that I would drink the stuff that was in that bottle. I knew I had no say over it. And I went over and began to pour it out, and I knew I wouldn't. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. And I stood back, and in a panic, I threw the bottle, and it hit the sink, and it burst. And, you know, if the bottle had bounced, I don't think I'd be here. And then I proceeded to spend the next 3 days not drinking. And I heard those things. I heard Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for 18 hours. It was coming out of the radiator of my car, the parking meter. I had to go borrow $300 to get into this place, and I'm listening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and stuff crawling on the seat of my car. Oh, it's amazing stuff. And somehow I knew when the 3 days was up, and I put stuff in this car and I took off. It was a 30-mile drive, and it took me 6 hours to get there. And I would drive about a mile, and a terror would set in, and I began to shake, and I began to cry, and I ended up wetting my pants. So I'm changing my pants beside my car on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out of my pocket. And I thought they were wrong. I mean, I was a kid with a potential. And I was a member of the World Congress of Genetics, and I was published and all this stuff. And here I am changing my pants beside my car outside of Washington, D.C. And I got to that place, and I got there just in time to learn two things. Number one, a woman told me I wasn't bad, I was just sick. Now, later, my sponsor was to say she was wrong, I was sick and bad. And the next thing that I learned was I was to get on a bus and go to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was an organization that used to exist, but I thought that once we had gotten so scientific, we no longer needed that. I mean, I thought AA went out when God did, but I got on the bus because I was desperate, and I rode along, and I went to the Alcoholics Anonymous, and a man greeted me at the door. He was an I guy, too. And he said a strange thing to me. He said, "Son, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And I wanted to say to him, "Buddy, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl." But, you know, he did know me. He knew me better than I knew me. And more importantly, he knew what was wrong with me. And he knew what would fix me. And I began, I think, what has to be the most exciting journey in the world. And, you know, for the gentleman who has 13 days, God bless you. We're so glad you're here. And for the gentleman who got the book, fasten your seatbelt. If you'll stay with this gang of lunatics, I promise you more excitement than you ever knew in your drinking days, ever knew. And it's incredible what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I hit the road running. I didn't even know for sure I was an alcoholic for quite a while. But I knew that whatever I was, the only place I seemed to have any hope was in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd be crazy all day, and I'd just keep watching my watch. And I'd leave the hospital, and I'd drive up to make sure I knew where the meeting was. And I'd look at a calendar to make sure I knew what day it was. And I was so confused. And some days I'd say to myself, "If you go home, will you come back?" And if the answer was yes, I'd sit there from 5:30 to 8:30 when the meeting began. And I just fell in love with you folks. You know, I was out of that treatment center, and I went to a meeting, and I bumped into a man named Dick L. And Dick greeted me at the door. And he said to me, "Is this your first time in our meeting?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "Well, you're most welcome." And he asked me my name, and he asked me where I worked, and he asked me the names of my children, and, you know, a bunch of questions. And I thought it was like cocktail talk. You know, the next week I went back, and this man who I vaguely remember came up to me and said, "My name's Dick, remember?" And I lied and said, "Yes." And he said, "Keith, how are you?" And I said, "I'm fine." And he said, "How are things at the hospital?" I said, "Well, they're fine." And he said, "Have you been able to talk to Kelly and Kimberly this week?" He remembered the names of my children. And I was hooked. I was hooked. I discovered that you people aren't phony. You really mean it when you say it. And I was launched into an exciting, exciting life. And I was insane. I mean, the first year I was sober, it was absolutely crazy. I couldn't sleep. And at the end of the meetings, they would say, "Is anybody here like to bring something up that might make them drink?" And I'd put up my hand. I'd say, "I can't sleep." And they'd take turns, you know, saying, "Nobody ever died from not sleeping," you know. And one day I jumped up and screamed, "No, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping." And I never got any more feedback after that. And I remember I had to go shopping. You know, I had to buy groceries, but I couldn't be in a grocery store for any period of time at all. I'd go crazy. So what I learned to shop in a little red basket. And so what I'd do is I'd go up to the Safeway on Wisconsin Avenue. I'd park my car, and I'd gather all my courage. I'd run in and grab that red basket. I'd take off. I'd go up and down those aisles like I was in that contest, you know, where you go shopping. And I'd grab, and you're allowed 10 things, right? So I'm going through the line, and by this time I'm sweating, right? And I guess it was a slow day or something. The guy said, "Pardon me, sir, you have 11 things." And I said, you're right. I don't deserve to shop here. You're right. And he said, "Oh, just a joke. And I turned around, there's a woman standing, her eyes are about that big. I said, "This man caught me sneaking 11 things for a 10-item line." And she just wanted to buy a few things and go home with her family. She didn't want to diss. So the manager came over and said, "What's the problem, sir?" I said, "You got to promote this man. He caught me sneaking 11 things for a 10-item line." And I did what any normal person do. I burst into tears and ran out of there. Now the problem with that is I told my sponsor, never tell your sponsor stuff like that. My sponsor had a saying, you know, it wasn't get in the car. It was, "You're where? You did what? get your ass over here. That was my sponsor. So I drove over to his place and I explained my side of the story. And he said, well, this is easy to fix. So we got in the car and I thought he was going to go up and punch the guy out or something. And we go up to the Safeway and he said, go on in, make amends. Said, no, please, he's going in there, you know. So I went in and, you know, the manager came running over. He said, sir, are you all right? I said, well, almost died from alcoholism. Mother had a square nipple and dad never told me he loved me or something like, you know, I had a whole string of reasons. And so the guy came over and I had to apologize to him. Then I had to pay for the groceries and they had them there. And I had to shop there for the next 6 months. So I go through the line, the guy look at me and go, 1, 2, 3, 4, ha ha, you know. So. It was awful. And that was the day I got up. And I got all dressed up and to go to work. And the problem was I couldn't remember where I worked. You know, here I'm driving around, I look pretty good. And I couldn't remember, and I panicked. And so I always carried a card. My sponsor had taped a dime to his business card and wrote his home number on it. And so I how do you call your sponsor and tell him you don't know where you work? Because I knew I was crazy, and when you found out, you weren't going to let me come to AA anymore. But I was just panicked, so I called him. I went to a phone booth, and I called him, and I said, good morning, Dan. He said, morning, Keith, how are you? I said, I'm fine, I'm wondering how you're doing. He said, well, I'm all right. And he said, what's all that noise? I said, I'm calling you from a phone booth. And he said, did your car break down? I said, no, car is fine, Dan, I was wondering how you're doing. And he said, what's the matter, buddy? I said, well, Dan, it's not a big problem, I just can't seem to recall where I work. And he said what he always said. He said, oh, you got the old I can't remember where I work problem. He said, a lot of us have had that. Well, I never met another person with that problem. So then the minute he told me, I not only knew where I worked, I knew what I did. It was like it was all in one package, you know. And if you got any of it, you got it all. And I was terrified, and he said to me, he said, it's scary, isn't it? And I said, oh, it sure is. And he said, you know, our book says that to pour alcohol in our brain is a very unnatural thing. And he said, it'll take a while for your thinking to straighten out. And I said, Dan, you think I might have brain damage? And he said, I'll be honest with you, Keith, it's a little too early to tell. And he said, but I'd like to make a suggestion. I said, anything. I'm honest, willing, and open-minded. He said, if you ever have this problem again, he said, try to remember to look at the front bumper of your car because you have a parking permit for the university. And I was thinking, where do these people learn these things? I mean, you made life look so easy, you know. It was just amazing. And one day, I was sober 3 months, I got a letter from a man named Jerome Lejeune, probably the greatest cytologist that ever lived, at least the greatest one I ever met. And he was in Paris, France, and he asked me to come and study staining techniques with him. He developed a staining technique for chromosomes, and I couldn't believe it. But I knew that if I took it to my sponsor, see, I'd figured out this sponsorship stuff. Sponsors are people who figure out what you really want to do and tell you you can't do it. That's what sponsors do. And I knew that I couldn't go to Paris. I knew that. So I wasn't even going to give him the satisfaction. But finally I decided, so we went to lunch and I showed him the letter. And he looked at it. He said, this is wonderful. I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. He said, this isn't about you. He said, the best you can do is crap your pants over there on Skid Row. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what this is. And I said to him, Dan, I didn't think you'd let me go. He'd say, look at me. As my mother used to do that, you know, say, look at me. And I looked at him and he said, I want you to remember this. He said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. And you know, that's the truth. I found that to be true. For almost 30 years now, I've been able to do anything and everything if I prepare properly. So if you're kind of new and think your life's over, oh, you are so wrong. You're going to go places and do things that you never imagined possible. You're going to plumb the depths of a spiritual existence, and you're going to laugh, and you're going to do things that you're going to become close to people because you're going to learn that wonderful, wonderful gift of receiving love, the ability to receive love. Tonight the homily at Mass was about receiving forgiveness, and so much of that is about receiving love, the ability to receive love. That mother who loved me so very, very much. You know, I took her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she loved you immediately. And she said to me, I said, Mom, is there anything I can do? It must have been awful having a son like me, worrying. I was discharged from the Marine Corps. It took me 10 days to go from North Carolina to Ohio. And they had a welcoming home party, of course. Now, they're all pre-Al-Anon, so they left the balloons and everything up, so I'd know. And, and you know, what happened to me was I was doing all right till I got to Charleston, West Virginia, and I went to the after-hours joint. I always visited. And there was a guy there with four ladies, and he was a businessman, and he'd been caught soliciting prostitution, and these were his business partners, and they were having a going away party. He was going to go to Moundsville State Penitentiary to serve 2 to 5 years for solicitation, and they asked me to join them. I mean, I was raised to be polite, and so I joined them and began to drink, and the next 3 or 4 days were like a haze. I was in and out of a blackout or a grayout or whatever it was, and I remember one time I'm driving this guy's Cadillac convertible up to the gate of Moundsville State Penitentiary. And the thing that was and all these girls were all crying and saying goodbye to them. And what was interesting was I didn't know I knew how to drive, because I sure didn't have a license. But I guess I could drive drunk and I couldn't drive sober. But it was crazy. And I finally got home. I was just insane. I mean, that's the way my life was. It was just absolutely insane. And I'd done these things to this poor woman. And she said, "Honey, you just keep staying with those people. That's all I want from you. You just keep hanging around with those people and you do what they tell you." And I got a 4-year token. It was the first token I got. In North Carolina, they invented the chip system, and it hadn't yet gotten to Washington, D.C. We were driving home from that meeting, and she said, "You know, I'd really like to have one of those coins one day." And so I gave her my token. And every year on May the 13th, I'd send she and my father a token. And she loved it so. And she loved you so. And, you know, they'd never been on a vacation, never been on a honeymoon, never owned an automobile, never done anything except give everything they had to their children and the other kids they raised. And I, in my sobriety, had wandered upon a little beach house down in Carolina Beach near where Mike lives now. And the name of the beach house was CZ Does It. I thought that I'd lay out a little hint. And my parents had never seen the ocean, and I invited them down to see the ocean, and they fell in love with it. And I said to him, I said, "I wonder if maybe you wouldn't keep an eye on my house for a while." They kept an eye on my house for 6 years. They kept an eye on my house. And we bought Dad a car, and he drove for the first time in over 40 years. And my mother took up painting, and within 6 months was a brilliant artist. She had gone back to finished high school, and then she took her college entrance exams, and she outscored all of us. And she said, "It's not a big deal. I've been through high school 12 times. And they just flowered. And Mike and I would, we often talked about, you know, we'd walk up on a porch sometimes, and he'd be sitting on a swing, and he'd have his arm around his honey, sitting on a swing, watching the waves of the ocean. And I stopped down there one day, and, you know, this man who never told me he loved me, I tried like crazy to get it right with him, and I did all the things I could, and we didn't agree on anything. And I remembered something I learned in the second grade. And I was approaching it all wrong. I was trying to figure it out. I was trying to meet him halfway. I was trying to do all that crazy stuff I learned in those self-help books. And then I picked up the big book. And I realized what I was supposed to do is honor him. And I began to honor him. I began to honor him the best way I could. I no longer had an opinion different than his. I learned from an Al-Anon friend that I could say, "You know, I never really looked at it that way before, Dad." So when he'd say these things were patently and absurdly wrong, I'd just say, "You know, Dad, I never really looked at it that way before." And it was true. I never had. And this magnificent man and I began to develop a relationship. And then one day we're sitting in a rocking chair, rocking, looking at the ocean. And he said, "Son, remember the first day you went to work?" And I said, "Yeah, I worked in a bowling alley." He said, "Yeah, you were 12 years old." And he said, "Do you remember that I took you to lunch on your first day?" I said, "You know, Dad, I don't think I remember." He said, "Yeah." He said, I took you to Louis' hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had?" And I said, "I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog?" And he said, "Of course you did, you loony." He always called me a loony. He said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Well, I probably drank orange pop. I always drank orange pop." He said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you drank root beer." He said, "I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer." And he said, "I explained to you how to do a good day's work for a good day's pay." He was explaining to his 12-year-old boy how to grow up. And he said, "I walked you down to the bus stop because it was in the next town. And he said, 'Son, do you want me to come with you on your first day?'" And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it alone. He said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight and you never looked back. And he said, from then on, you never let me help you. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them go to college, and you did it all on your own. He said, you put yourself through high school and you never let me help you. And I thought back to our book, and it says that people treat us the way we make them treat us. And I had robbed this man of doing what he did better than anybody in the world, and that was to be my father. And a week later, I borrowed $1,000 from him. And I put it in the bank, and a month or two later, I paid him back. And from that day till the day he died, we were best friends. I let him be my father. I started stopping by and taking advantage of the wisdom of this incredibly spiritual man. He'd always say something odd like, what do your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous say about it? He said, you know, I believe with your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and God, you can't go wrong. And I remember I was an officer in a corporation, and I just hated it. But you're supposed to do it. It was a lot of money, and I just hated it. And I stopped by to see him, and he said, I've never seen a happier man in my life than you since you met those people and they turned your life around. What would they say? I was always struck by his incredible love for you. You know, in the year 2000, I had a three-week stretch that was beyond belief. We were supposed to have our family reunion, and I was asked to speak at Founders Day. And it's got to be one of the greatest honors in the world to speak in Akron, Ohio. You know, AA was founded in Akron. I think if it weren't founded in Akron, it would have been founded in Texas. I really mean that, yeah. Now, you know it was founded in Akron, but I say it because there are people from California here who don't believe it was founded in Akron, but I just thought I'd say it. So I called up my dad, and I said, Dad, I'm going to be home, but I may miss the reunion because I'm going to be in Akron, but we'll leave Akron and drive home right away, and I'm going to spend a week with you. And he said, so he hung up, and he told the rest of the family, if Keith's not coming, we're not having a reunion. Now, you know, 28 years before that, they wouldn't tell me when the reunion was for fear I'd show up. And they moved it a week. Now, I mean, I had brothers and sisters traveling from all over the place. And I said to them, I am really sorry about this. They said, look, whatever makes dads happy makes us happy. And we want you to be there too. So I spoke at Akron. The following week, I had a picnic with my parents. My mother had gone by that, passed away by then, but my dad. A week after that, I spoke at the West Virginia State Convention in Wheeling, West Virginia, and 2 miles from my home. And my whole family was there. And when my father heard me speak for the first time, and he came up to me and he hugged me. And he kissed me on the cheek. And he told me he loved me. And he said, I'm so proud of you. He said, I want to thank you for everything you've done for so many people, especially the people in our family. And I hadn't realized how many of my brothers and sisters and cousins and nieces and nephews are members of AA and Al-Anon now. And I didn't say anything to them. I just got sober. Thank God I didn't say anything to them or they wouldn't be members. And I was overwhelmed with the circle that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I permit myself to accept the incredible amount of love that God and people have always had for me. You know, my mother was an extraordinary, extraordinary human being. And when she died what she called a beautifully painful death. She suffered from cancer for 6 months. It took as little medication as she could because she believed that suffering was a prayer if she offered it. And she used her suffering. She told me, I'd go at night, and she loved a rosary, and I'd pray the rosary, and she'd wake up and pray with me for a little while, and I'd read scripture, and she'd wake up and smile. And she loved poetry, and I'd read her The Vision of Sir Longfellow, you know, the part about not what we give, but what we share, the gift without the giver is bare. She read that to us once a month from the time I was a year old until I left for the Marine Corps. And we would pray together, she offered her suffering as a prayer that all her children would come back to God. And one by one, all of her children have gotten sober and come back to God. And you know, my sisters, God bless them, took such good care of her, and they, they put pictures of all the children, and they had 11 children, they had 20 grandchildren and 30 great-grandchildren, and they put them all with all the in-laws and, you know, daughters-in-laws and son-in-laws all over the wall. My mother would wake up and look at that and smile. And my brother Larry, who's in the fellowship, and I were up to visit her, and my niece came in, and she was all excited and said, "You have to come, you have to come in. My sponsor's speaking." And I said, "Well, I'd love to hear your sponsor." I said, "Maybe another time." I said, "I thought I'd spend the evening with Mom." And my mother said, boys, look at me." And we looked over there, and she said, "You go to that meeting. Always go to those meetings. Those are the people who brought my boys home to me. She loved you so much." And, you know, she listed the things she wanted in her coffin. And to the very top of the list was my 23-year token. The very top of the list. How can I thank you for that and for everything else? You know, my father passed away in December. And I went up to see him in October. And he was very lucid, and we talked. And we had those talks. And I said to him, before I left, I said, "Dad, is there anything we need to say to one another?" And he said, "No, son." He said, "I know you love me, and you know I love you." And I started to leave. And he said, "There is one thing." I went back, and I took his hand. And he squeezed my hand, and he said, "Again, I want to thank you for all you do for so many people." He said, "You keep giving what you have, and you keep getting more." And nobody knew that better than my father. And you know, when he passed away, we were around his bed, my lovely wife Julia and a bunch of us were around his bed, and I was holding his hand. And we prayed the Hail Mary, and then we prayed the Lord's Prayer, and I had told him it was okay to go. I said, "Go be with Mom," and my brother Terry had passed away, and I said, "Go be with Terry and Mom, and it's okay, we're okay." And I promised him, I said, "I'll pray for everything you pray for every day. You can pass it to me." Because he prayed for everything every day. I held his hand, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer. And when we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and went into eternity. And I left that room, and I said to my wife, Julia, I said, "This isn't supposed to happen to me. I'm supposed to be down the street trying to drink up enough courage to come here. I'm not supposed to live like this." Of course I am. I live like this because of you. Just because I'm one of you. Not a better one or a lesser one. Just one of you. You know, I had a lot of amends to make. And this, the theme this weekend certainly has been spiritual. And I'm profoundly grateful for that. And, you know, the book says that we don't apologize for God. And you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was one of those religiously anti-religious people. I sat around waiting to be offended. And when my eight-step list came up, I mean, I just loathed religious people, and because they're all hypocrites, we know that. And when my eight-step list, I had religious people, and I decided that I had to make an amend. So I went looking for a religious person, and I went to a retreat center, a Jesuit retreat center, where Mike and I have been to many, many retreats over the years. And I went down, and I was looking for this young theology professor. I'd gone back to school and taken a degree in philosophy and theology out of Georgetown. And I was looking for this young professor because he would understand the significance of this deeply humble act I was about to perform. And, you know, I couldn't find him. But there was an old man sitting in a room rocking in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And I knocked on a door, and I said, "Father, may I speak with you?" He said, "Of course." His name was Father Jim. And I went in, I sat in a rocking chair, and we sat and rocked, and I told him why I was there. I told him how ashamed I was of the way I had talked about people like him and what I had done, and I told him about going to Skid Row. I told him about my baby, Kimberly, and I told him about all those things. And I got halfway through. And the most astounding thing happened. This man of God got up, and he pulled me out of the chair, and he put his arms around me, and he began to hug me. And he said, "God sent you, son." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "God sent you." He said, "I have an illness that's going to allow me to go home soon." He said, "I was just sitting here asking God, as I understand him, my higher power, where I had missed it." He said, "I've been a priest for 50 years, and I asked him, where have I missed it?" And he said, "I realize now that too often I didn't do what my higher power told me to do." He said, He said, I stayed with the 99 who agreed with me. And he said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. God used me to go talk to a holy man so that he could be healed before he went home. Me. A walking blasphemy. Me. You know, if you don't want to watch miracle after miracle after miracle happen, you better leave Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you know, it's my great privilege. Mike and I do book studies in prisons and in halfway houses. And Mike does the book studies. I carry the book. And and if you heard him today, you know why. And you know, it's just, I'm going to step way out of line. This week, Mike and I discovered that Mike's cancer is back. And that means a lot to me, but it doesn't mean anything to Mike. And I've watched this man over the years do extraordinary things. I mean, heal people with his wit and his heart and his knowledge of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, his knowledge of God. And he's challenged me constantly to do the next thing. And he's led me places that I didn't think it was possible to go. I absolutely refused to discuss God, and he drew me a picture. I told him there's no such things as angels. I was just nuts. And he told me about my guardian angel, and I told him that was a myth. I was crazy, you know. I was a crazy man with a degree in theology. Now, you don't get much worse than that. And he drew a picture, and he told it was an Amish woman playing a piano and an organ, and he said that she was singing to the angels. And I wanted to throw it away. Of course, it's one of my prized possessions now. That's the kind of stuff he did. He encouraged me constantly throughout my life. And one night, in 1979, we got a, I'll end with this. It was a gas shortage, and I got a call from the intergroup office to take a 12-step call, and my car was absolutely empty. It was parked in front of the pump down at the service station. And the guy said, I don't know, I can't get anybody. Nobody can go on a call. I said, look, I'll take care of it somehow. And the call was over in Bethesda. We lived in Tacoma Park. And so I went to two doors down where Mike lived, and I knocked on a door, and I said, Mike, let me borrow your truck. I got a 12-step call. He said, my truck's totally out of gas. We had to push it in a parking thing. We talked about it, and we prayed together. And I said to Mike, I said, I'm going to go on a 12-step call. If I run out of gas, I'll run out of gas on a 12-step call. And he said, I'll pray for you. And so I took off, and a needle was gone. It was buried. And I drove over to Bethesda, and I got to the man's house, and I went in and I talked to him, and this guy was shaken apart, and we couldn't get an ambulance. It was a mess. And so I said to God, if you'll just get me to the emergency, to the hospital, I won't ask anything else. So I piled this guy in the hospital, and he's close to DTs, and I run him down to the hospital, and it took me about 2 hours to get him in. Back then, you had to actually go into DTs or convulsions before they believe you. And so we get him in finally. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I figured, well, I'll just drive someplace and park and sleep. And so I'm driving up Old Georgetown Road, and I cross Wisconsin Avenue, and the lights were on in the service station. It was an SO station, and I drove in, and the guy ran out and said, sir, we're closed. And I said, well, that's okay. I said, I'll just park here until in the morning because I'm not going to get home. I don't have any gas. And he said, look, he said, don't park here. They'll line up. And he said, I'll turn the lights out. I'll fill you up. He said, but then get out of here. I said, okay. So turn the lights out. And he filled me up. And he came to me and he said, sir, there's a mistake. And I said, what's that? He said, I put 23 and a half gallons in your car. He said, your car only holds 21 gallons. And I said, well, I want to pay you for him. He said, no, don't. He said, no. He said, it's impossible. He said, your car doesn't hold that much gas. And I said, look, pal, God loaned me a few gallons of gas. I want to pay for it. Now, you know, he took the money and got me out of there. Now, I went back to wake Mike up to tell him, but of course, Mike was awake praying, so I didn't have to wake him up. And you know what amazes me? He wasn't surprised. He wasn't a bit surprised. I love you so very much. And I ask you to please pray for my dear brother, Michael. And because whatever comes, it's going to be God's will. And we're going to accept it gladly. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you for who and what you are and what you made us. Thank you.
It is my great pleasure. I know what this is.
You're not going to tell me.
No, I'm not going to tell you.
You'll want it, won't you? You'll probably take it.
No, because it's got your anniversary date on it. I'm sober much longer than you are. Well, you new guys, after hearing that, you know you'll never have to drink again. That's why we always bring Keith to these things. Let's close. Thank you all. Let's close in the usual manner.